Kyron is on X at Kyron Samuels. Kai, what's happening, man? How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Happy to be back as always talking football.
Yes, I have to open here, though, because I haven't really gotten to discuss it on my show. But USC has lost four of their last five, and they have made a quarterback switch to Jaden Maiava, and Miller Moss is hopping into the portal. What do we think about that decision by Lincoln Riley? And it feels like, and we've talked about this on multiple occasions so far this year, it feels like Miller Moss has been a scapegoat when it feels unfair to make him a scapegoat for what has gone wrong with USC.
Yeah, 100%, especially when you're looking at the lack of balance from the offense. I think, when you look at the fact that Miller Moss is the quarterback and Lincoln Riley chooses to throw the ball at the highest clip of his career as a coach, think about that. I mean, you think about his coach career over 8 years. He's had Baker Mayfield, Kyler Murray, Jalen Hurts, Spencer Rattler, Caleb Williams, and now Miller Moss. And now is when you're deciding to throw the ball at the highest rate of your career. When you have two running backs who are averaging over 6 yards per carry. You have Willie Marks, who's the Mississippi State transfer, averaging about around 6 yards per carry. You have Quentin Joyner, who's averaging around 8 yards per carry. So you have the talent in the backfield, and you have a very young offensive line. So the marriage just didn't make sense in terms of the high percentage that he's choosing to throw the ball at. But even then, Miller Moss is number 12 in the country in passing yards. He's around top 20 in passing touchdowns as well. So it's not like he hasn't been efficient when he has thrown up the ball. It's just not conducive to winning. You're competing in these games, but you're not doing enough to win. You're not doing enough to preserve leads when you get them. Or when you do get down, it's very tough when you have no type of identity and no type of consistency to the offense, and you're down 7-10 points in the fourth quarter. You're going to have to throw the football, and they're rearing their heads back and coming after you with that pass rush. So I think Miller Moss has been a scapegoat. I think that Maiava is a very talented quarterback, the redshirt freshman transfer from UNLV, but he's a guy that I think they're going to get in there and run the ball a lot more, and they may have some success with that, but I think it'll lend people to believe that Moss is the problem instead of the balance in the play sheet.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange to me, too, because Jaden Maiava, he's young. Like, it feels like you're burning a red shirt on the guy right now, or at least throwing him in there when it doesn't feel like it's all that necessary with 3 games to go. That decision making, like, how much do you think that could come back to haunt Lincoln Riley? Because Lincoln Riley, you can holler at me about this as well. How hot do you think his seat is at 4-5?
Well, it's very interesting. We'll start with the hot seat question because I think it's a situation similar to Mike Norvell in Florida State. I don't think they can afford to get him out of there this year. He has an $88 million buyout.
Okay, only Kirby they can't Smart. Afford that. No, that's not affordable.
Only Kirby Smart has a higher buyout right now. So Lincoln Riley has the second highest buyout in the country. And it's a real problem because 4-5 at this point in the season is not acceptable. I mean, they just broke ground on a new facility. They invested a ton of money in the transfer portal and NIL. And they're losing recruits. They've had three recruits flip in the last 2 days, and apparently there's another couple coming. Their offensive tackle, a four-star from South Alabama, who was a very good get for them, is projected to be a Colorado flip. And then there's the Juju Lewis situation. He's one of the most decorated quarterbacks in the country. He's also predicted to be a Colorado flip. So if they lose those two to come on top of the recruiting, the seat should be hot, but I don't think they can do anything about it because of the financial situation. And then just kind of getting back to it, listen, Lincoln Riley is the guy who's been pretty stubborn in his coaching tactics, and he's been pretty stubborn sticking to his guns, and has been able to be overcome by superior talent at the quarterback position. I don't think that Jaden Maiava is the superior level of quarterback that he's used to having. Miller Moss is not the superior guy, but he's a very talented college quarterback, and I think that probably a step down from what he's used to, and he's kind of being stubborn about it, and leaning on a guy that has some of the traits that near a guy like Caleb Williams. I mean, I tweeted out last year before I even knew he was going to transfer to USC that Maiava, it looks like he's cosplaying Caleb Williams sometimes because, he wears the same stuff in terms of the gear that they wear, and then he tries to break out of the pocket and make some of the same throws with the arm pockets, and that's what happens. People emulate guys they look up to, like people do the same thing with, Rayola and Mahomes. So it looks like Maiava was kind of just modeling himself after Caleb Williams, and I think Riley saw that, which is why he reached out to them. So it's kind of funny that they end up happening, but he is not that level of talent. If he was, he wouldn't have been a UNLV in the first place, and that's not to say he can't be successful, but it's not good enough to lean on and overcome bad coaching.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in this game coming up this weekend on Fox, Nebraska and USC, because they are both in a world of hurt. You have a team that has lost four or five games and a team that's lost three straight games in Nebraska. Nebraska made the switch to one of our old favorites, Dana Holgorsen, man, at offensive coordinator. And he got there about a week ago, so I don't know how easy it's going to be to sort of get his game plan and his play calls and his sort of terminology all set into stone by the time they actually play against USC. But Dana Holgorsen's, I mean, he's like a cat. He's got nine lives.
Oh, man, 100%. It's crazy. You know, I actually wrote about this for USC Sports Illustrated this weekend. He's a guy that came in last week with no intention from Matt Rule's side or his side of being the guy. He came in to help. He just came in to offer some new eyes, offer some fresh perspective, and he was helping the then offensive coordinator, Marcus Satterfield, kind of, you know, get some stuff together. And then Matt Rule basically said, you know, this is pretty rash, this is pretty out of left field, but I feel like the best thing for us is to make a switch. So whatever they talked about during that two-week stretch, during that span, impressed Matt Rule enough to the fact that he's like, hey, we need to make a change. I know it's unconventional. I know it's not something you normally see. I'm going to go with Dana Holgorsen, and he talks about how peaceful the transition was and how Marcus Satterfield took a ton of accountability and kind of did some self-reflection. So it was interesting to see, at least the way Matt Rule painted, that it was a very seamless transition, even though it was unplanned and pretty much off the cuff. So that's interesting. But we know what we're going to see from Dana Holgorsen, right? He's a variation of the air raid,
yep.
Not too dissimilar from Lincoln Riley himself. I think Dana has done a little bit more with the tempo and changing up in terms of the looks. He'll do some more gadget plays. We'll see Dana throw some trick plays out there maybe once or twice a game. I mean, it's a staple in his arsenal. So I'm looking forward to see it because he has a very talented quarterback, maybe the most talented quarterback that he's had in a long time. But Rayola's been struggling as of late. So I'm interested to see if Dana Holgorsen can kind of take some of those bad habits and pull them out of Rayola and get a playing like the kid we saw earlier in the season.
There was some thought that they needed to make an offensive coordinator switch to keep Rayola around. Do you buy into that? Is that something that you think actually across Matt Rule's mind? Need to make an OC switch now because Marcus Satterfield and Rayola may not have been getting along the best because of this three-game stretch and the three straight losses.
You know, I think it's a double-edged sword. I think that 100% probably played into it, but I also think that's kind of the problem with the new age of college football.
Right.
You know, this is a guy that the first six games of the season, we had NFL draft analysts saying that teams should get ready to tank for him because he's that good. And then you go through a three-game stretch where you don't have the success, and now the guy's fired. There's a little bit of give and take here. There needs to be a little bit of accountability on both sides. I think the offensive coordinator situation was dire, and I think that maybe changes should have been made after the season. But Rayola just simply hasn't been playing well. If you look at the Ohio State game, there was open players that he missed. There was just simply missed throws. If we look at the UCLA game, there was just some flat-out bad decisions from Rayola. I saw that more than I saw poor game planning. So while I think the offensive coordinator position could have been upgraded, I think a lot of it right now is just a young kid playing like a young kid. And he needs those reps and he needs those situations to go through. So I think people are skipping steps a little bit, but I also understand the position that Matt Rule is in. And this is why I said it was dire, even though I don't think Marcus Satterfield was a bad coach. Matt Rule is kind of under the hot seat himself as well. He can't go 5-1, start the season, blow out Colorado, and have everybody thinking that this team is going to be a college football playoff contender, and then lose three in a row, and now you're maybe in danger of even making a bowl game or not. So this is a must-win game for both teams. I understand Matt Rule is kind of like, hey, I have to make something shake here. This is going to have to give. So I'm going to make a change off the coordinator and go with the guy that I know can produce points.
Yeah, it is kind of funny that you bring up that Colorado game. It feels like that was 5 years ago. was years ago, man. Like, that's a good win for them, but they have not found much luck since then. Now, you brought up Lincoln Riley and decommitments and how that recruiting class is looking right now. Mike Norvell is another example of that. He lost four-star quarterback commit, Trammell Jones. He pulled his commitment this morning, and it's the sixth decommitment for Mike Norvell's 2025 class. And according to ESPN right now, even before that decommitment, Florida State's recruiting class was sitting there at 37th. Like, this is sort of the – obviously, he has some things he can do. I think he'll get another year, and he can sort of stabilize that program. But obviously, it's going to be an uphill battle. He's going to have to go into the transfer portal, find some guys who can play. But this type of thing, when you see a recruiting class completely devolve mid-season, mid, 1-9 season, that feels like it's almost the beginning of the end, doesn't it? when you have a guy who's known for his recruiting, not recruiting at a high level, losing commits left and right?
Yeah, man, I think it just seems how fast things can change in this landscape of college football. Because Florida State is a respected program. They'll always be a respected program. But the landscape has changed, and kids are not going to come play for you just because you're Florida State, man. You have to show something viable and something that is a product that they want to be a part of. And 1-9 is hard to sell, man. It truly is, especially when you've seen the amount of transfers they've taken. I think what they're going to have to do is probably hit JUCO hard, try to find the best JUCO-ready players, probably try to find the best group of five-level talent that they can, because those are the guys that are going to come make an instant impact for them. And they don't have time to develop a ton of high school kids who probably aren't going to be the elite talent that they're used to getting them. So they're going to have to fill out this class one way or the other. I do think that because they're Florida State, some of the older guys will still be inclined to give them a shot. But they're going to have to hit transfer portal, G5, and JUCO pretty hard, in my opinion, especially if they're not able to turn their momentum around with the high school.
Yeah, brother, you can't. If you're Mike Norvell, you can't miss like you did this year. You can't fail in the transfer portal ranks like you did this year. Now, getting on to college football playoff rankings, what did you think of week two of the rankings?
I was pretty disappointed in the rankings, not because I thought the Royal teams were in it in the top 12. I think the order's just been out of whack, especially when you look at a team like Tennessee. It's pretty baffling to me that they dropped two spots after winning a game by 20 points without their starting quarterback for the second half. And then a team like Michigan and Penn State, they hold ground. Right. With their positions, and Indiana actually
Moved up three spots.
Yeah, and they barely scraped by 5-5 Michigan, who's playing without Will Johnson and playing without some of their best players. Rob Boyd's been out all year. They're doing the quarterback thing where they're switching their quarterback and they're trying to figure it out. I don't want to discredit the win. I think it's important to stay undefeated and get the win. But if we're looking at quality wins, if we're talking about strength of resume, strength of record, it's not one of those resume building wins. And they didn't look great in the eye test. So what is the justification for them jumping up over a team that just beat Alabama and then came back and handled business without their quarterback in the second half of the ball game, and now they're set up with a big matchup with Georgia? I think it's just a little bit of fan service because they're getting ready to play the Georgia Bulldogs, right? And if they do beat the Georgia Bulldogs, they'll probably jump in 3 or 4 spots ahead again. So I just wish there was some more rhyme to the reason, right? I wish there was a little bit more continuity and a little bit more transparency. And consistency as to why these rankings are what they are.
Yeah,
and you still have a team like SMU. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
You go ahead. I apologize. I'm bad about that.
No. It's just like there's still teams like BYU and SMU that I feel are underranked, right? Like if we're talking about quality wins and resume and the eye test, which they keep talking about, those are two teams that look a lot better, and they have the undefeated resume or one loss resume. So why aren't they up there when they have more quality wins than Penn State, than Ohio State does? It's just a little bit baffling to me.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I know that there's a bunch of 2-loss SEC teams, but when you look at their resumes, they're better than a lot of the teams that they're ranked behind. Alabama, Ole Miss, Georgia. Georgia's number 12, and they beat the number 3 team in the country at their place by 30. It was 30-15. It wasn't close. Texas never had a chance in that game. It's kind of funny because we always talk about SEC bias, but it felt like this week of rankings, they kind of underdid it. They kind of tried to buck against that normal SEC bias. And I know some people will disagree with that sentiment, but that's how it feels to me in particular. Seeing Georgia at number 12 with that win over Texas, with number 1 strength of schedule, number 3 strength of record, I know they have 2 losses, but to have them at number 12, I think is pretty insane in the grand scheme of things. Now, that thing, it could figure itself out. They play Tennessee coming up this weekend, and they could win. They'll be firmly in the college football playoff hunt. They can finish out the season. They'll be right in there. But it feels like the committee tried to buck against the normal SEC bias complaint that they get.
Yeah, it's a little bit baffling to me, right? And I want to talk about the committee and the fans a little bit, because this is a common discourse on social media. And even on radio, I did some radio here in Alabama the other day, and people kind of, giving me a little bit of crap for it. And I'm like, let's look at a team like Kentucky. They have some bad losses on their resume, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But they also have 2 ranked wins. They beat Ole Miss at Ole Miss. They beat South Carolina and gave them their worst loss of the season. They have 2 ranked wins in the top 21. That is more than the top 5 combined in the college football playoff. So you have Oregon, who has 2, Texas, who has none, Penn State, who has none, Indiana, who has none, It's embarrassing when it comes to the rankings and the consistency, in my opinion. So the quality of the schedule, top to bottom, if you look at the advanced metrics, SEC teams by far have the hardest schedules. If you look at the eye test, we already know Georgia, let's use them as an example, they've had to go neutral site with Clemson to win the ACC, on the road at Alabama, on the road at Texas, on the road at Ole Miss. There's nobody close to that difficulty level in terms of the eye test when we're looking at the level of talent on those teams. So it just needs to be a little bit more consistency, man. And you look at the middle of the road SEC teams, a team like the LSU, who could potentially play by virtue of the tiebreaker for the SEC championship, can also finish as low as 6th or 7th in the conference. A team like Texas A&M, if they were to lose a game or two, could finish 6th or 7th in the conference. That is, people say it's top-heavy. Well, I think it's more, if you want to say it's top-heavy, they have more over the top than anybody else. There's two teams in the Big Ten that we really consider the cream of the crop. There's Ohio State and Oregon, and we'll see about Indiana. The Big 12, Colorado maybe win that conference, but nobody thought Colorado would be considered cream of the crop. ACC, we thought maybe Clemson could get it back together, but Clemson has two losses. SMU is leading that conference right now in their first season. So if we're talking about the difficulty level, it's still the SEC, bar none, and I think people should give them a little bit more respect. And listen, it's a 12-team playoff, man. What'd you expect? They were getting two or three teams in when it was the 14 playoff. They were getting two teams in when it was the BCS. It's 12 teams. What'd you expect to happen?
Yeah, and speaking of SMU, who is sitting right now at number 14 in the college football playoff poll, they didn't even play this weekend and probably had the best week of their entire season because you had Miami go down, Clemson already went down, Louisville has two losses, Pitt added another loss. They're at the top of the ACC and in full control of that conference right now, and they have Boston College, Virginia, and Cal left. SMU, they're in a great spot in year one in the ACC. The only loss they have is against BYU, but if you remember, they lost 18-15, and immediately after that, Rhett Lashley pulled the plug on Preston Stone, put in Kevin Jennings. So that team, I think, is definitely underrated at this point in the year.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the one thing I wanted to give him a ton of credit for, Rhett Lashley, that is, the head coach at SMU, is that he had the guts to make that transition because Preston Stone was the guy that a lot of people were talking about is maybe winning the ACC Player of the Year, maybe being a high draft pick, maybe having some of those All-American honors. He was that talented coming into the season, so it was a shock to a lot of people. But I commend him for being able to have the guts and the fortitude to make that type of call because I don't think people realize how heavily invested SMU is. There's a lot of people in that Dallas-Fort Worth area that have invested a lot of money into that program and want to see it at the point it is. So it's not easy to just make these type of decisions because everybody has a boss. Even the boss has a boss. So having the guts to do that, I commend him, and it's paid off in an incredible way for them. And now they control their own destiny to get to the college football playoff.
Yep. Now, getting back to Georgia, they play Tennessee this weekend at home. It's their one game against, you know, really top competition that they actually get to play at home. They had to play Ole Miss, Alabama, Texas on the road, which leads to the number one strength of schedule. But is this finally the week where Kirby and that Georgia program can flex their muscles? Because now their back is fully against the wall. Needs to be a massive week of game planning, and they need to execute coming up on Saturday.
Yeah, I 100% believe. If I have to bet on anything in the college football world, I'm going to bet on Kirby Smart to have his team ready to play an elimination game. And that's what this is. They have an elimination game at home against a team that is kind of limping in there. Tennessee has done well this season. They have a fantastic defense. But we don't know the situation with the quarterback. Even if Nico is going to play, he's not going to be at 100%. So being able to dial up pressures, I'm expecting Glenn Schulman to have a fantastic game plan for the defense to get after Nico and kind of confuse him because he's still a young kid trying to figure it out. So let's say he does play, I still feel really good about Georgia's chances here because I'm going to trust Kirby. And another thing I want to throw out, it's kind of a little bit of a caveat. We have seen Carson Beck play rather bad this season.
Yes.
And they're still 7-2 against the schedule, 2-2 against ranked teams. If we get Carson Beck playing back close to the level that he was at last year or even early this season, the second half of that Alabama game, if he could play at that level, this team is still probably the most scary team in college football. Nobody's going to want to play them if they're able to get past them and make the playoffs. So that's the thing that I think people should keep in mind. They've been getting by. I won't say getting by. They've been surviving with Carson Beck at, I would say, like a C level, maybe D-plus level at top.
Right.
If Carson Beck can get back to that D-plus level consistently, this team is going to be hell on wheels to deal with. So I'm excited to watch him this weekend.
No, I'm not trying to shoot Carson Beck Bale, but what's been the big issue with him? Obviously, I think we overrated him heading into the season, so we'll start there. But also, like it is kind of true. Well, I don't want to accept the excuse of Ladd McConkey and Brock Bowers not being there, and Rosemead Jack-Saint and that type of thing. It feels like he doesn't have the type of weapons on the outside that he fully needs to be successful. Now that's also on him, because I don't know if he's the type of quarterback like Cam Ward or Shedeur Sanders that lifts up all the people around him. But it does feel like that has been a big problem for him at least the last 4, 5, 6 weeks.
100%. I think that when we look at it, the one thing that we've learned this season more than anything is that Carson Beck is not an elevator. He's a guy that has to be on a team that has a certain amount of talent set already, and I think he's trying to play above his means because the concepts are the same in terms of the route concepts and the quick game stuff that they want to do. A lot of the personnel is the same outside of Ladd McConkey and Brock Bowers. The offensive line is mostly the same because Amarius Mims, as good as he was, he wasn't healthy a lot, so they were having to play with most of the linemen that they're playing with now. You know, they have a ton of experience up there. The depth of the running back room may have been a little bit better in the past, but I think the biggest thing that we've learned is that if he doesn't have those dynamic-type players on the outside, he's not a guy that can elevate the offense, and that's fine. There's plenty of guys like that in the NFL. If you want to look at a guy like Jared Goff, even a guy like Jalen Hurts believes is one of those guys. That those guys aren't elevators per se, but they are plenty good enough to win when the surroundings around them are pretty good. So I think Beck is probably falling into that category. I want to give him a little bit of bail, though. I think if he can continue, because he always responds from the mistakes, right?
Yep.
If he can just stop making those mistakes and get back to that B level, like I said, he doesn't have to be A+ and do too much. He should be a B level quarterback. That defense is plenty good enough. They have plenty enough talent. And last thing before I pass to you, keep in mind, and we talked about this a little bit on the podcast, that guys like Ra-Ra Thomas,
yes,
and Colby Young, that were supposed to be major contributors, are not on the field because of off-the-field issues. And that's another reason why I think Georgia, in the national eye, is probably not going to get any bail or any leeway or any passes, because some of those are self-inflicted. And we see where they're struggling at right now. They need Colby Young. They need Ra-Ra Thomas. They were really dependent on guys like that. So that's a little bit of perspective, maybe why he's struggling a little bit. But I think if he could just get back to baseline level, Georgia would be pretty dangerous.
And they need to run the ball better. Like that's also part of it. Their O-line is just not the same as we saw it against Ole Miss. Their O-line is not clear. It's clearly not the same as it was a year ago, or 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. They're struggling pretty mightily. When they play against talented groups, they get their butts kicked. They get whipped.
Yes, 100%. They've had some injuries, too. Tate Rattles, I believe, missed 3 or 4 games. Jerry Wilson missed 3 games. So they had to do a ton of shuffling around the offensive line, and that's never good, especially when you're already dealing with some deficiencies in other places. So it's hard to get continuity in the game going, but they got Rattles and Wilson back last week, so I'm expecting another level to go up this week. You know, the more you play, the healthier you get. It's late in the season, but when you're dealing with an actual injury as opposed to just a regular attrition, you still get better as the season goes along if you're recovering from that injury. So I'm expecting to see those guys take another step this week. A big thing, like we talked about, is they're at home. You normally play your best at home. You're in your comfortable surroundings. You see everything that you're normally used to seeing. You eat the same meal. You feel good. You go to sleep in the same bed. So I'm expecting those guys to take another step this week and get the kid Nate Frazier the ball some more. I love Etienne. I think he's a very good spell back, and he's a guy that can do some really good stuff in terms of getting to the edges and those outside zone concepts. But Nate Frazier runs with a different intensity, in my opinion. So get the true freshman some more carries, and I think they'll be a little bit better in the run game.
All right, now is Travis Hunter the leader there for the Heisman for you? Is he the Heisman for you heading into Week 12? Only 2 more games to play, or 3 more games to play for Colorado.
I believe he is. My sense has not changed since the UCF game. I truly believe that coming into the season, after the North Dakota State game, watch him play. But, you know, nobody's going to give you Heisman hype after North Dakota State, right? As respected as they are. But after the UCF game, my mind was made up that, hey, this guy, if he continues this trajectory, he should be the Heisman to trade out. And he's done that and then some. He's actually probably, we really want to be, like, consistent about it. He's missed 2 games, essentially. He sat out the entire second half of the, excuse me, about 3/4 of the Kansas State game early in that game. And then the following week, when they play Arizona, he missed most of that game, being out with a little bit of a shoulder neck. So he's doing what he's doing production-wise without having played in about 2 games this season. So I'm even more impressed with the amount of production that he's had, because one, he's been able to stay on the field for relatively the entire season. And when he is on the field, he's producing at a level that we've never seen on two sides of the ball. The snap count is ridiculous. He played 170 snaps last week against Texas Tech. That's mind-blowing. I mean, when you look at it, some offensive splits, they're playing between 60 and 70 snaps a game. So he almost played three full games worth of offensive reps for some teams. So absolutely insane. I have nothing but great things to say about Travis Hunter. And from everything I hear, he's a great kid off the field as well. So I think that'll kind of get people to maybe vote for him a little bit, even though they have the Colorado hating there.
All right, now Thursday Night Football is actually, we've had some bangers the past couple of weeks, but we have Commanders and Eagles tonight for the top of the NFC East, and the Eagles are on a 5-game win streak. Commanders coming off that loss 28-27 against the Steelers. But I'm going to make a pick later. Can you convince me one side or the other?
What I will say is I'm going to go with the Eagles, because I believe that their defense has made strides that I didn't see coming. And when you have an offense as talented as they are, with Jalen Hurts at quarterback, Saquon Barkley in that backfield who's having a monster year, A.J. Brown, Devontae Smith, and now you have guys stepping up like a Jahan Dotson. He hasn't filled the stat sheet lately, but he's making two or three plays a game that is kind of making you account for him in the game plan. Or at least when you are going to focus on A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith, the Eagles are going to make you be able to pay for that now. Because even if you don't game plan for it, he's shown that he can make those plays. So the Eagles at least have more trust in him. So they're getting guys like that stepping up. I think they're going to be a team that is going to be a force to be reckoned with as long as they're healthy, and they are. So I'm even looking at the guys on the defense like Reed Blankenship and the kid Cooper DeJean, ever since he's been in South Carolina. He's playing very well. Quinyon Mitchell, the rookie out of Toledo, in my opinion, he's the defensive rookie of the year running away. I know Jerry Burst and some of those guys are having a good year in L.A., but Quinyon Mitchell has played as good as anybody at the quarterback position this year outside of Patrick Surtain. So I love what I'm seeing from that defense, and I'm going to trust them against the young quarterback, Jaden Daniels, that has been having a great rookie year, but I trust in the Eagles more top to bottom.
Yeah, and real quick, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring this up at least at the end of our segment. Shout out to the ass-kicking chickens. 6-game win streak. Your Jacksonville State Gamecocks. They're at the top of the Conference USA. If they win the next couple of games, if they win two games, they're going to be eligible. They're going to be in the Conference USA Championship. And last week against Louisiana Tech, that was nuts. They have a Hail Mary at the end of the game. They tie it at 37. And then they miss the extra point and have to go to overtime. They end up winning 44-37, but that was wild. That was probably the most wild game of Week 11.
Oh, man, it was insane. I woke my lady up screaming because I'm oh, my God, I'm going so crazy because of the Hail Mary conversion, right? And then that great feeling, that euphoric feeling I had, went to the sickest feeling, one of the sickest feelings I've ever had because of the missed extra point. Because you couldn't really see it on the TV copy. All you saw was the kicker grab his head, and you're like, oh, my God, what just happened?
Right.
The angle that they were at was kind of angled to the side, so you couldn't really see if it was good or not. But, yeah, it was a stressful experience, but I'm happy they were able to pull it out. And shout-out to Trey Stewart, the running back. Man, he's having one of the best years in all of college football. He has 17 rushing touchdowns, which is up there in the top 10 in the country. So I'm excited for him because he's been able to kind of take advantage of his opportunity. But ass-kicking chickens, like you said, man. Hopefully to get to that Conference USA title.
Yes, sir. You the man, Kai. We'll talk next week.
Appreciate it, man.
Yes, sir. He is Kyron Samuels. He is a college football and NFL analyst at Sports Illustrated. Also, make sure you check out our podcast, G5 Classified Podcast, on Bluff City Media and the Believe Podcast Network. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, full-length video version on YouTube. Our guest list has been off the hook lately. We had Justin Fuente last week. We had ESPN NFL draft analyst Jordan Reed this week. So make sure you go check that out wherever you get your podcast.